Welcome to the Deep Dive, your essential shortcut to navigating the cutting-edge frontiers of science and medicine. Today, we're plunging headfirst into the microscopic world of cellular combat. We're exploring some truly novel therapeutic strategies that are, well, reshaping how we think about fighting disease. Our mission for this deep dive is really to explore how understanding and then subtly modulating the most fundamental processes inside our own cells. Things like how they manage their energy, how they recycle components, even how they decide, you know, to end their own lives. How all that can unlock entirely new ways to combat devastating illnesses. We're talking specifically about breakthroughs in areas like cancer and neurodegenerative disorders. It's a really fascinating frontier. It promises, well, precision and power in medicine.
And our mission for you, as always, is to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge from the sources we've meticulously compiled. Think of this as your fast track to being thoroughly informed about these complex, sometimes surprising, cutting-edge approaches. We'll definitely be looking for those insights that maybe challenge prior assumptions, reveal unexpected connections, and crucially, offer clear practical implications that make the information stick.
Okay, let's unpack this broad concept of therapeutic potential. When we dive into the sources, I mean, a really clear trend emerges, doesn't it? By truly understanding and then expertly manipulating the basic functions of our cells, we can develop some incredibly powerful new treatments. This isn't just about treating symptoms anymore. It's a profound shift, getting right to the very heart of a cellular dysfunction and kind of rewriting the rules of cellular life and death.
Yeah, what's truly fascinating here is just the sheer diversity of the strategies being explored. But they all converge on these core cellular fundamentals. We're talking about everything from how cells generate energy, process waste, manage stress, to how they ultimately decide to die. It's not a search for one single magic bullet, you know.
Yeah.
It's more like understanding and maybe orchestrating this complex symphony of highly targeted interventions.
Right. And when we talk about that cellular energy, well, many studies really emphasize the therapeutic potential of tinkering with mitochondria. You know, for those maybe less familiar, mitochondria are often called the powerhouses of the cell. But why are these tiny organelles so central? Both in health and disease, why are they such attractive therapeutic targets?
Well, mitochondria are absolutely critical. They play this profound kind of dual role that makes them central to the pathology of both neurodegenerative diseases and cancers. Our sources highlight compounds like MitoQ. That's a highly specialized mitochondria-targeted antioxidant. And what's really fascinating and honestly a significant breakthrough is how MitoQ can selectively inhibit mitochondrial respiration. But it does this in normal healthy cells without compromising the tumor-killing efficacy of, say, aggressive treatments like radiotherapy.
So wait, it's about protecting the healthy cells while still attacking the bad ones. That sounds like a monumental game changer, especially in therapies like radiation where collateral damage is, well, it's a huge concern, isn't it? Minimizing those harsh side effects.
Exactly. Precisely. This offers a potentially revolutionary new strategy for, say, radioprotection. Imagine being able to use a more aggressive radiation dose on a tumor, knowing MitoQ is shielding your healthy cells. And this precision extends elsewhere, too. MitoQ is also a powerful inhibitor of mitochondrial lipid peroxidation and a specific type of iron-dependent cell death called ferroptosis.
Ferroptosis.
Yeah, this has been clearly shown with agents like Erastin or RSL3, which are known triggers. The fact that MitoQ blocks this suggests a crucial pathway for intervention. And even more compelling, if you overexpress a specific mitochondrial ferritin isoform called MTFT, which has this remarkable ability to bind and sequester labile iron right inside the mitochondrial matrix. Well, that also significantly inhibits ferroptosis, whether it's induced by chemo agents like doxorubicin or even simulated ischemia perfusion injury. So it strongly points to the critical role of iron accumulation in these specific mitochondrial death pathways. It highlights a new vulnerability we can exploit.
And it's not just MitoQ, right? Are there other mitochondria targeting compounds or maybe broader strategies showing promise in the sources?
Yeah, definitely not just MitoQ. Beyond that, we see triphenylphosphine-based compounds being actively explored. These are ingeniously designed to accumulate specifically within mitochondria because of their positive charge, allowing for highly localized delivery of therapeutic agents right to the cell's power plant. But the focus isn't only on specific drugs. The sources also highlight more general principles, things like maintaining mitochondrial integrity via what are called NAD plus dependent sirtuins. NAD plus is crucial for energy metabolism, and sirtuins use NAD plus to regulate various cellular processes.
Okay.
This pathway seems particularly important in conditions like, say, diabetic cardiomyopathy. There, supplementation with nicotinamide riboside, or NR, which is a precursor to NAD+, has been shown to actually increase cellular NAD levels and promote mitochondrial biogenesis, basically encouraging the growth of new, healthy mitochondria. So bolstering the cell's natural energy machinery can be a really powerful therapeutic avenue.
That's a lot of intricate cellular machinery being targeted. How do researchers even measure these changes, you know, in mitochondrial function to know if these compounds are working as intended? It seems like you'd need incredibly sensitive tools to see what's happening at that level.
That's a crucial question, absolutely. Without reliable measurement, these insights would just stay theoretical. Our sources do mention established methods like assessing mitochondrial membrane potential, MMP, which is a key indicator of mitochondrial health and function, essentially, how charged their inner battery is.
Right.
They do this using sophisticated fluorescent probes, things like JC1 chloride and RH12 fluorescence. These probes accumulate in healthy, highly charged mitochondria, and a decrease in their fluorescence, or maybe a shift in their emission spectrum, indicates depolarization and dysfunction. This kind of quantifiable measurement is absolutely crucial for evaluating how these compounds are actually working at a precise cellular level. It gives concrete evidence of their impact.
Okay, so moving from the cell's energy centers to its recycling system, autophagy, that's another massive player, isn't it? It's sometimes described as the cell's self-eating process. How is modulating the system showing therapeutic potential, and why is it often called a double-edged sword?
Autophagy, yeah, literally self-eating, is indeed the cell's essential housekeeping and recycling process. It's crucial for clearing damaged components, misfolded proteins, even entire worn-out organelles. And you've hit the critical point.
Yeah.
It truly is a double-edged sword. The sources show that both enhancing and inhibiting it can be beneficial, depending on the specific disease context. Compounds like rapamycin, trehalose, spermidine, carbamazepine, and tamoxifen are all being actively explored for their ability to precisely modulate autophagy.
Mm.
And for researchers, identifying autophagy often involves, well, visualizing autophagic vacuoles with electron microscopy or quantifying LC3 puncta fluorescent aggregates of the LC3 protein. This highlights the involvement of key proteins like LC3B, ATG5, and ATG12 in this complex process.
I've definitely heard of rapamycin, usually in discussions about like anti-aging or maybe immunosuppression. What's its specific role here in manipulating autophagy for disease treatment?
Rapamycin is a well-known, potent MTORC1-dependent autophagy activator. Basically, it works by inhibiting the MTORC1 pathway, which then flips the switch to turn on autophagy. In the context of neurodegenerative diseases, it's specifically shown promise in ameliorating the toxicity of polyglutamine expanded Huntington. That's the abnormal protein linked to Huntington's disease.
Okay.
So it's a clear, compelling example of autophagy's therapeutic role in proteinopathies diseases, where toxic protein aggregates build up. By boosting the cell's natural clearance, rapamycin helps mitigate the effects.
And methylene blue, MB, keeps cropping up everywhere in our sources. What's its connection to autophagy specifically, and what is the surprising versatility it seems to have?
Methylene blue is quite remarkable, yeah. Truly a multi-talented molecule.
Mm-hmm.
In the context of autophagy, it's been shown to powerfully attenuate tauopathy.
A feature of Alzheimer's, right?
Exactly. A key pathological feature. And it seems to do this by increasing markers associated with autophagy, suggesting it helps the cell clear out those problematic aggregated tau proteins. What's more, MB protects neurons from MPP plus induced toxicity. That's a common lab model for Parkinson's disease. It does this by activating the NRF2 pathway.
NRF2, that rings a bell. Antioxidant response.
Precisely. The NRF2 pathway is a master regulator of antioxidant systems. Its activation by MB leads to a significant reduction in oxidative stress and mitochondrial impairment hallmarks of MPP plus damage. In fact, MB can even prevent MPP plus anti-Duke apoptotic cell death in these neurons. It really cements its broad neuroprotective role.
So MB is a neuroprotectant, an autophagy modulator, among other things. But you mentioned earlier that autophagy itself is this double-edged sword. Is activating or inhibiting it always beneficial, or is it truly, as you said, deeply context-dependent?
Oh, it's absolutely nuanced and deeply context-dependent. That's exactly why it's a double-edged sword. While methylene blue can be protective by activating autophagy and antioxidant systems, autophagy itself can sometimes cause harm. Our sources indicate it can be neurodestructive. For example, by excessively degrading essential mitochondria in MPP plus treated neurons, which is obviously bad for cell survival.
Right.
However, in other contexts, it can be powerfully neuroprotective by selectively sequestering damaged mitochondria, essentially quarantining and recycling them in various CNS neurodegenerative diseases. It just highlights that the outcome depends heavily on understanding the specific cellular context, the timing, the level of modulation. On a fundamental level, we also learn that autophagy is naturally induced during the shift from glycolytic to respiratory growth, a metabolic transition that stimulates mitochondrial translation.
Oh, so it's all connected.
Exactly. It shows how intricately intertwined these fundamental processes are. Lots of potential points for intervention. And that transcription factor, an RF2, also plays a broader role in activating autophagy in response to stress.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting for me. Manipulating the cell's redox state. For those of us maybe not steeped in biochemistry, what does that actually mean? And how does it translate into therapies, especially for cancer?
Right. It basically means exploiting the distinct balance or imbalance of oxidative and reductive molecules within healthy cells versus malignant cells. Cancer cells often have a different, often more stress redox environment. They're in a state of, let's say, delicate imbalance. So the goal of redox manipulation and therapy is often to strategically induce more oxidative stress, specifically in those cancer cells, pushing them past a critical threshold, forcing them towards cell death, while ideally sparing healthy cells.
Exploiting a difference.
Exactly. That difference in baseline redox state offers a critical therapeutic window. Our sources note that reactive oxygen species, ROS, are naturally generated as a byproduct of normal cellular respiration. And while too much ROS causes damage, they also play complex roles. They activate intercellular signaling pathways in CNS diseases, contributing to inflammation, apoptosis, even regulating autophagy. Mitochondria are ground zero for ROS generation and are highly sensitive to ROS damage. We also learned that methionine and its metabolites can directly modify mitochondrial ROS production. And hydrogen sulfide signaling through persulfidation, that's a specific type of protein modification, is another active research area modulating redox state. Even immune cells like neutrophils contribute to tissue repair by promoting reparative macrophages through regulated ROS production. It highlights the complex, sometimes beneficial, roles of ROS.
So are there specific compounds or approaches designed to leverage this subtle but powerful redox imbalance?
Yes, absolutely. Metal protein attenuating compounds, MPACs, are a prime example. They're emerging as a therapeutic approach for neurological disorders. These compounds work by restoring metal homeostasis, particularly of transition metals like copper and iron, which can become dysregulated in disease and really contribute to oxidative stress. By reestablishing this balance, MPACs directly help decrease that damaging oxidative stress.
And methylene blue, again, how does it fit into redox manipulation, given all its other roles?
Well, MB's role in redox is quite direct and central to its protective effects. As we touched on, it powerfully activates the NRF2 pathway.
The antioxidant master regulator.
Exactly. And this activation leads to a significant increase in the cell's own antioxidant molecules, directly reducing oxidative stress. Yeah. Its radical scavenging capacity, its ability to neutralize harmful free radicals, can be directly measured, confirming its role in fighting oxidative damage. This is a key part of its broad neuroprotective profile.
Okay, so beyond these broad processes like energy, recycling, redox, our sources also talk about targeting very specific molecules, almost like precision strikes at the molecular level. How does that approach work?
This is really the frontier of precision medicine. Take Alzheimer's disease, AD, for example. We know amyloid beta, apeptides, and hyperphosphorylated tau proteins are central pathological features. So strategies that enhance the degradation or clearance of these abnormally folded proteins, whether it's AB and tau in AD, alpha-synuclein in Parkinson's, Huntington in Huntington's, or TDP43 in ALS, they consistently show beneficial effects in alleviating neurodegeneration. And methylene blue, as we discussed, directly attenuates tauopathy. It actively helps reduce those problematic tau aggregates. Our sources also highlight a fascinating connection. Amyloid beta peptide itself can increase contact between mitochondria and the endoplasmic reticulum, which is significant because this directly alters mitochondrial function and also the formation of lithophagic zones. It demonstrates how these specific protein aggregates tie right back into broader cellular processes.
It's almost like cellular spring cleaning, isn't it? Getting rid of the clutter, the toxic buildup that causes disease makes intuitive sense.
Precisely. This cellular housekeeping is essential. And that finding about amyloid beta increasing contact between mitochondria and the ER is crucial. This disruption of organelle communication directly impacts mitochondrial function and autophagosome formation. It links specific protein pathology to fundamental cellular machinery. Moreover, the sources show that lysosomal proteolysis, the breakdown in the cell's recycling bins, and autophagy itself actually require presenilin 1. That's a protein central to Alzheimer's pathology. And these processes are disrupted by Alzheimer-related PS1 mutations. It suggests an extensive critical involvement of autophagy in AD pathogenesis, further emphasizing the importance of clearing these protein aggregates.
Are there other specific protein targets mentioned in our sources? Things being investigated for therapeutic potential?
Yes, definitely. HSP70, Hedgehog protein 70, that's a vital chaperone protein involved in protein folding, and stress response is mentioned for pharmacological targeting. Our sources give a very detailed mechanism for one of methylene blue's actions here. It actually oxidizes specific cysteine residues, C306 and C267, in HSP72, which is a member of the HSP70 family.
Okay, very specific.
Extremely. This oxidation leads to a loss of ATP binding, which is absolutely crucial for HSP72's function in protein quality control. Experiments strikingly show that if you mutate these key cysteines to serine, HSP72 becomes largely resistant to MB in vitro.
Wow.
Even more intriguing, overexpressing the C306S mutant blocked MB-mediated loss of tau in a cellular model. And pseudo-oxidation mimics these C267D and C306D mutants' reduced ATPase activity and tau levels. It provides a very precise mechanistic understanding of how MB might be acting on tau pathology.
Fascinating detail. Any others?
Then there's NDUFAF1. This is a nuclear DNA-encoded mitochondrial matrix protein. It temporarily associates with complex CI subunits during the early stages of CI assembly complex, being critical for the electron transport chain in mitochondria. Defects in NDUFAF1 lead to serious CI assembly issues and increased breakdown of CI subunits. It suggests if they aren't properly incorporated early on, they're prone to degradation.
Okay.
It's thought to act during the initial assembly of a membrane subcomplex involving ND2 and ND3 subunits. Also, an adapter protein called EXIT interacts with NDUFAF1 to control CI assembly, showing this complex regulatory network governing mitochondrial health.
What about controlling cell death more directly? I imagine that's a very precise and powerful target, especially in diseases where rogue cells cause damage or where you need to eliminate specific problematic cells.
Indeed. The sources highlight MFN2, mitofusin 2. Its downregulation in excitotoxicity causes significant mitochondrial dysfunction and delayed neuronal death. This points to MFN2 as a potential therapeutic target to prevent neuronal loss. And crucially, caspase is often called the cell's executioner. Enzymes and apoptosis are directly targeted. Methylene blue, remarkably, inhibits caspases by oxidizing their catalytic cysteine. For example, C163 of Casp6.
Huh, so MB hits caspases too.
It seems so. This offers a fascinating dual potential effect. It could provide an additional neuroprotective effect against Alzheimer's by dampening excessive neuronal cell death. But it raises an interesting question. Inhibiting these fundamental cell death pathways might, conversely, potentially predispose chronically treated individuals to cancer by inhibiting the natural mechanisms that clear damaged cells.
Oh, the double-edged sword again.
It's a classic example of the delicate, complex balance in biological systems and the need for careful consideration in drug design.
So we've talked about all these complex biological targets, these intricate mechanisms, but developing brand new drugs from scratch, it's incredibly expensive, time-consuming, high failure rate. Is there a more practical, maybe faster approach being explored to bring these insights to patients?
This raises a very important and pragmatic point that our sources really highlight. What about existing drugs? The concept of drug repositioning, finding new uses for drugs already approved for other conditions, is presented as a very promising strategy because it leverages known safety profiles, established manufacturing, existing clinical data,
right,
which can dramatically accelerate development.
Right.
You bypass a lot of that early, expensive, risky preclinical and phase 1 testing. It significantly de-risks the drug development pipeline.
That makes so much sense. Less risk, potentially faster to market, significant cost reduction. Seems like a smart shortcut, especially with the vast data we already have on existing compounds.
Exactly. It's a pragmatic and incredibly cost-effective approach to expanding our therapeutic arsenal. The sources specifically highlight its potential, particularly for targeting autophagy to induce cancer cell death. It allows researchers to quickly test hypotheses about how existing drugs, already proven safe in humans, might interfere with disease mechanisms in novel ways. This kind of innovative thinking is absolutely key to bringing life-changing treatments to patients more efficiently, leveraging existing knowledge in entirely new contexts.
Okay, let's dive deeper into apoptosis, this incredibly precise, programmed way for cells to die. Sounds a bit counterintuitive, maybe, that we'd want cells to die, but it's absolutely essential, isn't it? It's not just what causes death, but how cells choose to die.
Absolutely. Apoptosis is crucial for maintaining tissue homeostasis, that healthy balance in our tissues. It meticulously removes damaged, transformed, or infected cells, plays a big role in development, even influences aging. When this highly regulated process goes wrong, either too much cell death, or more commonly in diseases like cancer, it's dysregulated and inhibited, it directly contributes to various human diseases, including the uncontrolled proliferation of cancer cells and their frustrating resistance to many anti-cancer therapies. Its precise control is really a cornerstone of cellular health.
And here's where mitochondria come back into the picture in a very dramatic way.
Yeah.
How do these powerhouses control apoptosis? What's their critical role in initiating this programmed cell death?
Right. A key early event in the intrinsic mitochondria-mediated apoptotic process is something called MOMP. That's the permeabilization of the outer mitochondrial membrane. Think of it like the cell's power plants developing a critical leak in their outer wall. It's kind of a point of no return for the cell. When MESMP happens, it's followed by the crucial release of cytochrome C from the inner membrane space out into the cytoplasm. Once cytochrome C is in the cytoplasm, it triggers this cascade of enzymatic events, activating the cell's executioner enzymes, the caspases, and ultimately cell death. We see this mechanism clearly illustrated in studies where, for instance, MPPE-PDT, a specific type of photodynamic therapy, led to increased cytochrome C in BACs, that's a pro-apoptotic protein, in the cytoplasm, coupled with a decrease in BCL2, an anti-apoptotic protein, all signaling the activation of this crucial mitochondrial apoptosis pathway.
And where do those damaging reactive oxygen species, ROS, fit into this? Are they just collateral damage, or do they actively participate in triggering apoptosis?
Mitochondrial production of ROS plays a direct and very active role in initiating apoptotic signaling. While some ROS is normal, even necessary, excessive levels, often induced by therapies, become acutely damaging. Many anti-cancer agents, including well-known drugs like anthracyclines, clearly exploit this. They generate high levels of ROS. This leads to lethal oxidative stress and widespread mitochondrial disruption, which can then trigger either apoptosis, the programmed death we're discussing, or sometimes necrosis, a more chaotic cell death. It's a powerful, often decisive weapon in the anti-cancer arsenal, disrupting the cell's energy and signaling balance.
So if mitochondria are so central, how do we specifically induce apoptosis by targeting these pathways therapeutically? What are the main strategies?
Well, one major strategy is designing drugs to directly induce MMP, that critical membrane permeabilization. These drugs can work in several sophisticated ways. They might target mitochondrial membranes directly, like punching a hole in the wall, or they can specifically interact with members of the BCL2 family of proteins. Those are the key regulators of MMP.
Pro and anti-death signals.
Exactly. This family includes both pro-apoptotic proteins, encouraging death, and anti-apoptotic ones preventing it. So manipulating their balance is critical. Additionally, drugs can target components of the permeability transition pore complex, the PTPC. Think of it as a crucial gate on the mitochondrial membrane that, when opened, commits the cell to death.
Okay, give us a concrete example of a drug that does this, maybe targeting those BCL2 family members to push cells towards apoptosis.
BH3 mimetics are a prime example of this highly targeted approach. They're designed to induce apoptosis specifically in tumor cells by mimicking the pro-apoptotic BH3 proteins. They do this by occupying the BH3 binding domains of anti-apoptotic proteins like BCL2 and BCLXL.
So they block the blockers.
Essentially, yes. By binding these anti-death proteins, BH3 mimetics neutralize the cell's survival signals, allowing the pro-apoptotic proteins to activate and trigger the cascade. It's a very elegant way to resensitize cancer cells to death signals, especially those that have developed resistance.
What about the opposite approach, preventing mitochondrial problems to keep cells alive, like in neurodegenerative diseases where you want to prevent neuronal cell death?
Absolutely. Conversely, inhibiting mitochondrial fragmentation, splitting apart of mitochondria, for example, with a compound like MDV1, can actually decrease MOMP and subsequent apoptotic cell death. Mitochondrial dynamics, that balance between fission splitting and fusion merging, is critical for their health.
Right.
Our sources mention that dynamin-related protein 1, DRP1, and mitochondrial fission factor, known F, are key proteins in fission, and elevated fission is seen in certain conditions, potentially linked to triggering mitochondrial apoptosis. Also, MFN2 downregulation is directly linked to mitochondrial dysfunction and delayed neuronal death. It further emphasizes how maintaining proper mitochondrial structure is key for survival, especially for neuroprotection.
Are there any other interesting compounds directly targeting mitochondrial death pathways mentioned in the sources?
Yes, a few. AT101, also known as Gossypol, is one. It induces mitochondrial dysfunction, which then leads to excessive mitophagy, the selective degradation of mitochondria by autophagy. This process leads to a distinct form of cell death in glioma cells. It's initially non-apoptotic, but can be accompanied by mitochondrial fragmentation. So a unique mechanism leveraging mitochondrial breakdown.
Mm-hmm. Mitophagy-induced death.
Yeah. Another compelling example is coenzyme QO0, a quinone derivative. It induces mitochondrial PTP, that permeability transition pore opening. This triggers apoptosis via ROS-mediated VDAC1 upregulation in leukemia cells. It's even been shown to effectively suppress tumor growth in xenograft models, showing significant in vivo potential.
Wow.
And additionally, inhibiting the mitochondrial calcium importer has been shown to protect neurocytes from ischemia perfusion injury by inhibiting excessive mitophagy. It further illustrates how tweaking specific mitochondrial channels can prevent cell death and pathology.
Okay, you mentioned earlier autophagy is a double-edged sword. How exactly does it interact with apoptosis? Is it always clear-cut or does it vary?
It's definitely complex and highly context-dependent. That's why it's the double-edged sword. On one hand, autophagy can be profoundly cytoprotective. It acts as a survival mechanism. It can protect cells from oxidative stress, even chemotherapy-induced apoptosis, by downregulating pro-apoptotic proteins like BAD and BIM. This protective role, unfortunately, can actually contribute to chemo resistance in cancer, allowing cells to evade treatment.
So cells use autophagy to resist treatment. That's the opposite of what you want in cancer therapy. How do researchers deal with that?
Exactly. It's a major challenge. But then on the other hand, uncontrolled or excessive autophagy can itself lead to a distinct form of cell death called autophagic cell death. This is why, paradoxically, inhibiting autophagy, for example, with the well-known drug chloroquine, can actually sensitize cancer cells to chemotherapy-induced apoptosis, makes the chemo more effective.
So inhibiting the protection makes them vulnerable again.
Precisely. This strategy of combining chemotherapy with autophagy inhibitors is currently being explored in numerous clinical trials to try and overcome chemo resistance.
And what about light-based therapies? Do they play a role in this interplay between apoptosis and autophagy?
They absolutely do. Photodynamic therapy, PDT, is a fascinating approach. It uses light to activate a photosensitizing agent in cells, which then generates ROS. PDT can induce various cell death pathways, apoptosis, necrosis, necroptosis, autophagy. The specific pathway depends on factors like the photosensitizer's uptake and its localization within organelles. Methylene blue, MB-mediated PDT, MB-PDT, it's particularly interesting here. Our sources show it induces selective and massive cell death in various human cancer cell lines. Some reports show elevated rates of tumor apoptosis following treatment, suggesting it preferentially triggers this programmed death pathway.
So MBPDT is highly targeted, aiming to minimize harm to healthy cells. That sounds like a huge advantage.
Our sources confirm that. MBPDT can achieve greater efficiency in selectively killing cancer cells with virtually no dark cytotoxicity, meaning it's not toxic without light activation, a big safety advantage over traditional chemo. Crucially, normal-like cells, like breast epithelium, are much more resistant to MBPDT. That's fundamental for safe usage and reinforces its advantage, potentially fewer side effects. This selective killing is even enhanced when MB is put into nanocarriers, like mesoporous silica nanoparticles, allowing even more precise delivery. Studies also look at how photosensitization with compounds like DMMB and MB affects mitochondrial inner transmembrane potential and how lysosomal photodamage can suppress apoptosis, highlights the complexity and multi-target nature of PDT.
Are there any other unique ways to trigger apoptosis discussed in the sources beyond the mitochondrial and autophagy interplay?
Yes, several distinct mechanisms are highlighted. For example, cantharidin. It's derived from blister beetles.
Interesting source.
Yeah. It promotes apoptosis in tongue squamous cell carcinoma cells by suppressing miR-214, a microRNA, and by regulating key proteins like P53, a tumor suppressor, and the BCL2-BAX balance, effectively pushes these cancer cells towards death. Then there's morin, a flavonoid. It enhances anti-cancer activity by upregulating death receptors DR4 and DR5 and modulating BCL2 through ROS generation in human hepatocellular carcinoma cells.
Mm.
Different compounds, distinct pathways, but the same therapeutic goal. Inducing cell death.
So different paths to the same goal really speaks to the many vulnerabilities we can potentially exploit in diseased cells.
Precisely. The complexity offers many avenues for intervention. We also see that anthracyclines, common chemo drugs, can sensitize cancer cells to TRAIL, that's TNF-related apoptosis-inducing ligand-induced apoptosis.
Yeah.
Overcoming tumor cell resistance to TRAIL alone suggests a powerful synergy. Furthermore, demethylation treatment in pancreatic cancer cells can inhibit autophagy and induce apoptosis by initiating endoplasmic reticulum stress. Shows how disruptions outside mitochondria can also lead to programmed cell death. And at a more fundamental level, S-adenosylmethylcysteine, a metabolite involved in methylation, is associated with apoptosis, particularly when triggered by enhanced ROS and activated caspase 3. Reinforces the critical link between metabolism, oxidative stress, and the cell's ultimate fate.
Now for the Warburg effect, a concept that really shifted our understanding of cancer metabolism and has recently undergone quite a reevaluation. What exactly did Otto Warburg observe back then, and what was the initial interpretation?
Right. Otto Warburg observed that cancer cells preferentially use glycolysis, breaking down glucose for energy, even when there's plenty of oxygen available. He called it aerobic glycolysis. This leads to significant lactic acid production, a hallmark of many tumors, often making the microenvironment acidic. While it was groundbreaking, it led to a historical misconception. The idea that mitochondrial respiration was severely impaired or maybe even absent in cancer cells, implying they relied almost solely on this less efficient glycolytic pathway.
So that initial understanding has evolved quite a bit, with more advanced research revealing a more nuanced picture.
Yeah, here's where it gets really interesting and represents a significant paradigm shift. Current research gives a much more nuanced understanding. Our sources indicate an ongoing reevaluation of cancer cell metabolism. It's now clear that the enhanced lactic acid production doesn't necessarily come at the expense of mitochondrial respiration. In fact, mitochondrial respiration is often much higher in cancer cells than in normal tissues.
Higher.
Much higher. It indicates a distinct and highly flexible metabolic rearrangement. Cancer cells aren't simply impaired. They utilize every available pathway, both glycolysis and mitochondrial respiration, to support their uncontrolled proliferation. It's not about relying on one paired pathway. It's about remarkable adaptability and maximizing resource acquisition for aggressive growth.
So mitochondria aren't just sitting idle in cancer cells, despite the high glycolysis. They're still critically involved. That overturns a long-held belief.
Far from idle. They play a crucial central role in the metabolic flexibility of cancer cells. This flexibility lets them adapt to hostile microenvironments. Low oxygen, nutrient deprivation, common within a growing tumor. This metabolic rearrangement allows them to seamlessly switch between glycolysis and oxidative phosphorylation as needed, maintaining their aggressive growth and survival, leveraging all available energy pathways.
Okay, if we understand this complex metabolic shift, this rearrangement, how can we use it against cancer? How do we therapeutically target this metabolic flexibility?
Well, by strategically inhibiting glycolysis, or by carefully modulating mitochondrial activity. Since cancer cells often have this enhanced glycolytic rate, shutting it down can effectively starve them of energy and building blocks. This approach also includes drugs that affect enzymes in the tricarboxylic acid TCA cycle, central to mitochondrial respiration. The goal is to disrupt their energy supply lines or force them into metabolic pathways they can't sustain.
Are there specific classes of drugs designed for this kind of metabolic targeting, tailored to cancer's unique energy needs?
Yes, definitely. Mitocans are a class of drugs specifically designed to target the unique, often altered metabolism of cancerous mitochondria. Their aim isn't just to inhibit, but to exploit the inherent redox imbalance often found in cancer cells and to induce oxidative stress selectively in those cancer cells.
Selectively. That's the key.
That's the hope, yes. Offering the promise of a truly selective and tolerable cancer treatment, one that kills tumor cells by leveraging their metabolic vulnerabilities without severely harming healthy tissues, that's a major hurdle currently.
What about how cancer interacts with its surroundings, the tumor microenvironment? Does that also play into this metabolic picture?
It does. This leads us to the fascinating concept of the reverse Warburg effect. This highlights how cancer-associated fibroblasts, key components of the tumor's supportive microenvironment, can themselves exhibit aerobic glycolysis and oxidative stress.
The support cells do it too.
Yes. And this metabolic activity in the surrounding stromal cells can, in turn, promote DNA damage and tumor progression in the adjacent cancer cells via a bystander effect.
It suggests that targeting stromal oxidative stress, the stress in the supportive tissue, not just the cancer cells, could be a powerful new therapeutic approach. Disrupting that crucial feedback loop adds another layer of complexity and opportunity.
And how does MitoQ, which we discussed for radioprotection, fit into this broader metabolic targeting strategy, given these nuances? MitoQ leverages precisely these differences in cellular energy phenotypes for highly selective therapies. While normal cells primarily rely on robust mitochondrial respiration, tumor cells often heavily rely on aerobic glycolysis, the Warburg effect. MITRQ is designed to induce selective autophagy in normal cells for radioprotection, without significantly impacting tumor cells, because their metabolic reliance is different.
Ah, it exploits their different energy preferences.
Exactly. It's an incredible level of precision, exploiting a fundamental metabolic distinction for a highly targeted therapeutic advantage.
And methylene blue, here too. Again, it truly seems to be involved in everything.
Yes, indeed. MB's versatility is remarkable. From what we know about its role in mitochondrial respiration modulation, methylene blue has been shown to reduce the Warburg effect in certain cell types. It does this by activating the TCA cycle, effectively shifting metabolism away from primary reliance on glycolysis back towards oxidative phosphorylation. By disrupting the cancer cell's preferred pathway, it potentially starves them of building blocks. Another angle for intervention.
We also look specifically for information on tumor reoxygenation in our sources, maybe as a way to make tumors more vulnerable to treatments. But it seems our sources didn't directly cover that in the context of cancer treatment, did they?
That's absolutely right. While the sources discuss a wide array of therapeutic concepts, metabolism, cell death, and the term reoxygenation does appear, they do not contain direct information or specific discussions about tumor reoxygenation as a deliberate therapeutic strategy in cancer treatment. The emphasis in our sources is more on the intrinsic metabolic adaptations of cancer cells and selectively targeting their vulnerabilities rather than manipulating oxygen delivery to the tumor as a direct treatment.
But the term reoxygenation did appear just in a completely different context, like tissue injury after oxygen deprivation.
Precisely. Reoxygenation is mentioned specifically in relation to ischemia reoxygenation injury in organs like the brain and heart. This refers to reperfusion, the return of blood flow and oxygen to previously ischemic or oxygen-deprived tissues. Paradoxically, this sudden return of oxygen can often lead to further oxidative stress and cell death, exacerbating the initial injury.
Yeah.
Myocardial ischemia reperfusion injury, intestinal ischemia reperfusion injury, these are explicitly discussed as significant clinical challenges. Studies show a protein called Parkin regulates programmed necrosis and myocardial IR injury. An S-nitrosylation of Parkin, a form of oxidative modification, can induce mitophagy during these events. Ischemic post-conditioning, a protective strategy, alleviates injury by enhancing autophagy and suppressing oxidative stress via pathways like ACTGSK3 in RF2.
Oh.
Yes. NRF2 also regulates PINK1 expression under oxidative stress, and PINK1 Parkin signaling can be activated by a sharp drop in mitochondrial membrane potential during ischemia. But it's crucial to distinguish this complex physiological process from deliberately reoxygenating a tumor for therapeutic gain. That wasn't a focus of our provided sources.
Okay, so what does this all mean when we bring it together? What's the big picture of these therapeutic strategies, looking at all these intricate cellular mechanisms we've explored today?
Well, if we connect all these threads, our deep dive collectively underscores a growing and really incredibly sophisticated understanding of fundamental cellular processes, metabolism, apoptosis, autophagy, the precise targeted modulation of these intricate interconnected mechanisms. It's truly unlocking novel therapeutic avenues that were almost unimaginable just a few decades ago. It's a fundamental shift towards truly understanding and influencing the cell's inner life, its destiny.
It sounds like we're moving beyond a simple one-size-fits-all view of disease towards a much more nuanced and crucially more targeted approach, hopefully more effective and less brutal for patients.
Exactly. The shift from a singular, often oversimplified focus on the Warburg effect to a more dynamic, flexible view of cancer metabolism, coupled with our increasing ability to selectively target mitochondrial dysfunction and finely tune cell death pathways. It offers significant promise. Promise for developing treatments that are not only more effective, but crucially, less toxic. This precision minimizes harm to healthy cells, which has always been a major challenge in therapies like chemo and radiation.
And that practical approach you mentioned earlier, drug repositioning, that seems absolutely crucial for accelerating these breakthroughs, getting them to patients faster.
It truly is. The emphasis on drug repositioning provides a pragmatic and remarkably cost-effective approach. It allows us to leverage existing knowledge, extensive safety data from conventional drugs, vastly accelerating the path from basic research to clinical application and patient care. It's an intelligent way to maximize our current pharmacological resources and bring innovation faster.
So the journey continues, right? This isn't the end of the story. It feels more like the beginning of a whole new chapter in how we approach medicine.
Absolutely. Continued rigorous research into the complex, often surprising interplay of these cellular mechanisms will be utterly crucial. crucial for developing even more effective and selective therapies for a wide range of diseases, from devastating neurodegenerative conditions like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's to various forms of cancer. We're truly only just beginning to tap into the therapeutic power of deeply understanding the cell at its most fundamental level.
Think about that. How these microscopic battles inside our cells are fundamentally reshaping the entire landscape of medical treatment, not just for one disease, but for so many seemingly disparate conditions. What other seemingly small or overlooked biological mechanisms might hold the key to breakthroughs we can't even imagine yet? We hope this deep dive has given you plenty to mull over and perhaps even sparked a new curiosity for what's next in medicine.